They Were Afraid, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
For to proclaim the resurrection of Jesus, an empty tomb, is not good news, not for sinners, apart from his death for sinners.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon and an Ascension sermon for any size gift during the 50 days of Easter. Make a secure online donation today, issuesetc.org. Thanks for your support during the Easter season.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It is really a rather remarkable science. It's about uncovering evidence, physical, material evidence, and then trying to sort through it, classifying it, trying to figure out what it means, where it belongs. Archaeology has proven to be, well, as one of our guests often says, the Christianity's best friend when it comes to the historical claims made by the Old and New Testament. What about Jesus himself? What about the little town where Jesus grew up, Nazareth? We're kicking off a five-part daily series on biblical archaeology on this Monday afternoon, April the 23rd. Joining us to do so, Dr. Craig Evans. He's Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada and author of several books, including his latest publication titled Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd. Good to be with you.
What's the best body of evidence that we have access to right now for Jesus himself?
The best evidence, really, is literary. And that would be, I would put at the very top of the heap, Paul, because he was a hostile witness. He was Saul, or his Hebrew name, or Paul, his Roman and Latin name. And he was an opponent of the early church. When he was converted and began to develop as a Christian and eventually a Christian leader, he actually knew the people who knew Jesus. And so what we have then is a firsthand witness, someone who had been hostile, who was converted by a dramatic experience. His mind changed. He got to know the people who knew Jesus. So I would have to say Paul, and everybody agrees, Paul is a real person. I've never heard of anyone who suggests that he was a fictional character. Real person, wrote letters. No matter what some skeptics say, everyone agrees that at least seven of the letters in the New Testament he wrote, and in a couple of those letters, he talks about Peter and other disciples who knew Jesus. So I'd have to say that's the best body, that's the best place to begin. And then a close second would be the first century Gospels themselves.
So you're saying that when we're looking for hard evidence, we don't need to immediately jump over the New Testament material, but it ought to be kind of at the top of the list for answering the question, did Jesus really exist?
Yes, that's right. And you know, Todd, I realize there are some odd books occasionally in a strange documentary or some claim gets kicked around in the media about, you know, Jesus didn't exist or he's an Egyptian myth or something like that. This comes from very strange circles. It doesn't come from people with expertise in the field. You don't have to be a Christian to believe that Jesus existed. There are lots and lots of agnostics, non-Christians, Muslims, Jewish scholars, right on down the line, people of all stripes and persuasions. They don't have any doubt that Jesus existed, and it's because most people are guided by common sense and evidence. And so, there are a lot of people we don't doubt lived in the past, but there's not one record from an eyewitness. You know that, but we accept it anyway because the evidence is good enough. It's circumstantial. There's a little bit of evidence. That's enough. In the case of Jesus, as I said, we've got written records from people who either knew him directly, and I think we do have that kind of eyewitness evidence in the New Testament. But even for skeptics, you have Paul, and Paul knew three or four or more people who knew Jesus personally, and that counts for a lot. And that's why most people, if they're fair-minded and guided by common sense, they don't doubt that Jesus existed.
Okay, just a word, if you would, as you do in the beginning of your book, about archaeology. We kind of have this kind of swashbuckling image of the archaeologist, some guy with, you know, big, heavy eyebrows, you know, digging around in the dirt. And then he sits in his tent at night by lantern light examining his artifacts, kind of trying to spin an interesting story out of what he's found. But you say archaeology is very, very intensely scientific. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is, and it's cataloging lots of information. It's making sure we have the right context. We're digging at a level that we can date. We know where we are, when we are, that kind of thing, and lots of evidence. Unfortunately, you know, the Indiana Jones movies give you the impression that archaeology is all about an adventure where you loot something, you find a precious item that bad guys want, too. You know, it's all very sexy and exciting. But I'm afraid archaeology is a little duller than that. And it's just inch by inch unearthing things and then interpreting them in context, because it's the context that makes the difference. You know, we hear about an ossuary, a bone box, maybe it has somebody's name on it. We get all excited. But if we don't know where it was actually found, then a lot of its value is lost. That's because context is so important. We want to find it in a tomb. We want to then reconstruct the family lineage, the family tree, try to understand the social status of this family, and we can learn all kinds of things about it. And that's what archaeology often does. It gives us the color, the background, and so a written narrative, whether it's a biblical document or something else, takes on new life because now we understand the culture, the customs, we know what the ancient writer is talking about, and that's why archaeology is so important.
And it's not just spades and brushes and tweezers anymore, is it? There's some real technology involved.
Oh, it's space age. You know, it really is. Thanks to satellites and imagery, we're able to detect what you might call distortions or interruptions in the lay of the land, and we suspect, hey, there might have been a road there or there might have been a city, and so we get an idea of where to dig. Because of X-ray, because of CAT scans, because of ground-penetrating sonar, we're able to look for things, find out that there's a cavity underground, a cave that might contain things. We can find graves, things like that. And we can also trace pottery, which is so interesting. We can analyze the actual composition of pottery. And why that's important, it's helped us realize rather dramatically that a village just a few miles from Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, produced 75% of the pottery in all of Galilee. Now, that is really something. And pottery was needed on a daily basis. Pottery for the Jewish people is almost like paper plates and styrofoam cups. It got rapid turnover. And for that pottery to be traveling around on the roads from one village that much shows you how much travel there was, how much commerce. It shows us how committed the Jewish people were to purity, which is why pottery had to be replaced. So it's that kind of thing, and science makes it possible to actually find a piece of pottery, say, okay, test that, and then find out, oh, this is its clay source. It came from this village. That really is amazing how that helps science and helps archaeology get on with its task.
How difficult has, you spoke about Nazareth, and that's kind of the subject for the remainder of our conversation, how difficult has the archaeological task been with respect to Nazareth?
Well, Nazareth, unfortunately, a lot like Jerusalem, Nazareth is a modern city, 60,000 plus people, and we've got a lot of asphalt, a lot of modern concrete, a lot of building, and it covers up most of the original building, so most of the original village. So we're not real sure precisely where the village is. I mean, most think we're within a mile or half mile of it. And these little villages in antiquity, you know, they could just be a stone's throw from each other. And so Nazareth, the modern city, probably lies on top of two or three villages. So anyway, there has been excavation. We have found the ruins of buildings that go back to the first century. We found evidence of terrace farming, viticulture, that is producing grapes and squishing the grapes, you know, to make the juice. Also milling, also unearthing stone for building and that sort of thing. So we get a sense that it was a fairly active village or cluster of villages, but it's just hard to get at the stuff because, you know, people don't give people permission to dig underneath their house or underneath the street. So it is awkward to do archaeological work in Nazareth.
Now, the picture, and this has kind of been the typical picture that's painted in Bible class and Bible encyclopedias, Bible dictionaries about Nazareth, an out-of-the-way worker's village, probably little more than a worker's village connected to construction projects nearby. You say that picture is out of date now.
Yeah, it is. For a long time, we thought of Nazareth as a bit of a economic backwater, sleepy little village. And if you really wanted serious work, you had to walk for a long distance to get to a place like Sepphoris. Now we realize, wait a minute, we've traced the roads. Sepphoris is about an hour and 20-minute walk, which would in antiquity would not have been a long commute for somebody on foot. Of course, some people would have ridden on a mule, and so that would not have been a long walk at all. And so Sepphoris likely did attract some builders. Joseph and his sons were builders. So Jesus may well have been in Sepphoris, which was 4 miles away, as growing up and as a teenager. As a teenager, the city was undergoing expansion. However, Nazareth itself had a lot of economic activity going on. So it wasn't like it was a sleepy village, a lot of unemployment or something like that. They had plenty to do, a lot of things going on there. And it was connected with roads. Jesus did not grow up in rustic isolation. He wasn't place-bound. But even as a youth growing up, he would have got out and about and would have seen parts of Galilee, probably made a few trips all the way down to Jerusalem. According to the Gospel of Luke, he did so at least once when he was a young lad. So I think we need to get a little more modernized and up-to-date in our understanding of what Galilee was like. It really wasn't just a sleepy, rustic place. But it was active, a lot of commerce, and even some cities.
Well, when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Craig Evans. He's Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada and author of the book Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence, beginning a series with him today on biblical archaeology. We're talking about Nazareth.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Hi, this is Jonathan Collin from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. Issuesetc.org. Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Is the abortion pill safe?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Is RU486, the so-called abortion pill, as safe as its supporters assert? The answer is no. But thanks to Monty Patterson, more people are becoming aware of the risks. Monty's daughter took the pill to end an unplanned pregnancy. It killed her. He investigated the drug and found that it had also killed a woman during its test trials. Outraged, Monty demanded changes. In response, the FDA has finally mandated that a warning be placed on the drug's label. He has also set up a website explaining the health risks associated with RU486. It's abortionpillrisks.org.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
The Easter hymn, Awake My Heart with Gladness, sung by the Cathedral Singers. You can hear it right now at Lutheran Public Radio. All through the Easter season, the 50 days of Easter, we have sacred music for the world at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Easter season, LutheranPublicRadio.org, 24/7, all through the Easter season. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking about Nazareth, part one of a five-part daily series with him on biblical archaeology. You mentioned before the city of Sepphoris there, and I was intrigued by you talking about Joseph and Jesus then. In his youth as builders, we usually hear carpenter, and the picture kind of narrowly emerges of a guy who just walks around with a plane and a saw and works with wood. What should we know about that term that's used in the Gospels for Joseph about his particular occupation?
Well, the Greek word that's used is tekton, and it can be translated carpenter. That's not really wrong, but it has a broader meaning, and so builder really is the better idea. And of course, anyone that works with stone also works with wood, and so they always go together. So it's likely a better term for it is builder, and that would mean not just making furniture or plowshares or something like that, but it would also involve actually laying out foundations, walls, building homes, which always involved wood as well. And so with Sepphoris being expanded under Herod Antipas, the Tetrarch, there had been a lot of work opportunities for builders in and around that city. And in fact, one suggestion I think is very interesting, and I lean toward it, I think it has a lot of merit, is in going to Sepphoris, Jesus became acquainted with a theater that likely was built by Herod Antipas in the teens of the first century. It would be expanded and made much larger toward the end of the first century, but in its smaller original version, Jesus would have been familiar with it. And we hear Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount mimicking the play actors, what we translate sometimes as hypocrite, really in the Greek means a play actor. And so disfiguring their faces, making hand gestures, giving soliloquies, having a trumpet sounded. And so it sounds like Jesus deliberately employs some of the theatrical language and imagery that he may well have observed firsthand at Sepphoris, and then he makes good use of it in describing the religious hypocrites of his own day.
You also mention, I think, that as a builder, it's Jesus is, of course, a metaphor factory, but some of his metaphors are decidedly constructural. They are decidedly kind of architectural in their force. Would that have also come from this experience?
I would think so. He tells, to go back to the Sermon on the Mount, he concludes it with a famous parable about the wise man who builds on a very solid foundation. And it didn't matter how hard it rained and rivulets of water rushing by, the foundation remained solid, the house didn't collapse. This contrasts with the fool who doesn't listen to what Jesus has to say. He's like the man who then builds on sand. And of course, we know what happens then. If it rains and the water goes washing by, the foundation is undermined and collapses. So I suspect from firsthand experience, Jesus has observed, you know how some buildings fared, some very well because they were founded and built right, and others that were built poorly. He would be, of all persons growing up in a household of builders, would have been very sensitive to that.
Now, we have heard in that Sepphoris connection from more skeptical Bible scholars that Jesus was heavily influenced by the school of cynicism, not the way we think about it today, but a Greek philosophy of the cynics, which had some association with Sepphoris. How do you take that apart, Dr. Evan?
Well, you know, that was a big thing back in the 1980s and early 90s. And part of it was just how surprised we all were at the excavations of Sepphoris. Here we are just 4 miles away from a small village of Nazareth. Here's this city on a hill whose lights no doubt could be seen at night. And turns out to have a paved main street, even columns, some fairly sophisticated, fancy-looking buildings built in Greco-Roman style. And people then leapt from that observation to the idea that it was really a Greek-Roman kind of city with Greeks and Romans running around, including Greek and Roman-style philosophers, and that would include the cynics. And because Jesus does poo-poo commercialism and materialism in some of his teaching, and so do cynic philosophers, some people then tried to connect the dots. And I think they made a mistake, but they ended up saying, oh, Jesus must have been just like a cynic. And it turns out that as excavations continued on into the 1990s and beyond at Sepphoris, we actually found the city dump. We were able then to do the stratigraphy and figure out accurately which part of the city was built prior to 70, that is, in Jesus' time, and which part of the city came later, after A.D. 70, which wouldn't relate to Jesus. We then realized, no, wait a minute, in the time of Jesus, it was very Torah observant, that is, they were Jewish people, devoted to the law. They didn't eat pork, for example, whereas later you have Gentiles, you have pork bones found in the dump and that kind of thing. We found very religious Torah observant Jews in Jesus' time. The whole idea of a cynic presence just evaporated, and so most scholars today reject that theory. They don't think there were any pagans or cynics in Sepphoris influencing Jewish boys from nearby villages, including Jesus himself.
So basically, there is, in the archaeological evidence, a change in the artifacts that you can discover pre-70 AD, post-70 AD.
Yeah, you can really see it, because before 70, that is, in the time of Jesus, there would be the ritual immersion pools that were popular with the Jewish people. You have the menorah, the seven candle lampstand. You have stone vessels, which Jews used, even though they were heavy and clumsy, because they resisted impurity. But what you didn't have prior to 70 were pig bones, coins with pagan images, pagan idols and pagan images, pagan buildings, where there would be burlesque or a striptease or something like that. However, those things start showing up after 70, after the Jewish revolt, and the Roman occupation, and the ethnic makeup of the city of Sepphoris changed. That's when we had an influx of Greeks and Romans. The Jewish population percentage went down. One third of the bones that we found in the dump after the year 70 were pig bones. They were eating barbecue ribs, short ribs, and so on. Nobody did that in the time of Jesus. And so archaeology, you see, gives us that context, helps us understand, okay, now we know what kind of people were living here in different periods of time. In Jesus' time, they were Jews. They took the Jewish heritage and their Jewish faith seriously. There weren't any pagans, and there weren't any cynics.
Now, obviously, Nazareth and Sepphoris are not the only places in this region. Let's talk a bit about Capernaum, which Jesus will, early in his Galilean ministry, kind of make it, well, I think, his home, if not only his headquarters. Am I right?
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, you know, the impression we have when he returns to Nazareth, described in Mark chapter 6 and also in Luke chapter 4, where he goes home to his hometown to preach, it's almost like he's a stranger. It's almost like, oh, yeah, I remember him. And the reaction of the people would suggest that Jesus had been away a long time. So I think it's right to say that Capernaum was more than just his headquarters, but had pretty well had become his home, and he was well known there. However, the sobriquet was still Jesus of Nazareth. He was still remembered as Jesus from the village of Nazareth. He never became known as Jesus of Capernaum or Jesus of Jerusalem or Jesus of something else. He was always known as Jesus of Nazareth. Capernaum was a key location on the Sea of Galilee. It was a busy fishing port. It also was on a key location with the highway system, both to the north and the northeast, and to the south and the southwest and due west. And so there was a lot of foot traffic, a lot of commerce. That's where tax collectors could be found as well, collecting tolls on the roads. And so it was a place where if you wanted to preach and say things, the message would travel fast. And so I can see why, on lots of levels, Jesus would choose Capernaum as a base of operations. He could also jump on a boat and head due east and just cross the lake to the other side. And that's what we see him doing in the Gospels.
We're talking about the archaeological discoveries in and around Nazareth, beginning a five-part daily series with Dr. Craig Evans, Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada, about biblical archaeology. He's authored several books, including his latest titled Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. You can give us a call with a question or a comment live this Monday afternoon, 23rd of April. Our call-in number 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or send us a tweet at @issuesetc. You can find out more about Dr. Craig Evans' new book, Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Jesus in Capernaum, about he seems not only to be the small-town boy, but quite familiar with city life, or at least small city life. And then Dr. Evans mentioned this a moment ago, when Jesus does return to Nazareth, where he is there preaching in the synagogue, if I'm not mistaken, not only do people seem somewhat unfamiliar with him, they are, well, they're outright hostile toward him. What does that tell us about the religious climate in the little town of Nazareth where Jesus grew up? We'll be right back.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Do you believe that there's not one error in the Bible? That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a recording of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Pentecost Sunday, May 27th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons. Now, when you make your gift, please indicate whether you want a downloadable version or a CD of these sermons. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the Easter season.
We're talking about the archaeological discovery in and around Nazareth, the town where Jesus grew up. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Let's go to the phones and see what Herman has to say. He's listening in Illinois. Hi, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Evans, you mentioned the sudden change in population at Sepphoris from an Israelite population to a Gentile population around 70 AD. Would this be related to the Jewish revolt and the destruction of the temple at that time? And could you explain further that, please?
It's a great question. Thank you very much, Herman. Dr. Evans.
Yeah, I think you're right, Herman. That's exactly what happened. There were dramatic changes in Galilee, also in Jerusalem, because of that war, and that change is seen rather abruptly in the stratigraphy of the city dump. I know that sounds strange. Indiana Jones, I don't think, would ever be found digging in a dump, but that's where archaeologists go because these cast-offs give us a good idea of what's going on. And so we find broken pottery in the dump. We find sometimes inadvertent things that are thrown out, like coins. We can find used tools that have been discarded. We can also find, of course, faunal remains, animal bones. And it's not hard to find the 70 line because of these dramatic changes. And so once you find that line, as it were, what's below it is older. We know that it would reach back then in the decades before 70, back to the time of Jesus. And then, of course, what's above it is what is newer, or after the time of 70, after the time of Jesus. And archaeologists have not found a single pig bone in the pre-70 dump, city dump of Sepphoris, but when you get after the year 70, the faunal remains change dramatically, and so pig bones get to become representing about one-third of all the bones. And so that is consistent with other factors that indicate that a significant non-Jewish population moved into the city. The city was not seriously damaged by the war. And that would be another reason why it was popular, because the Roman army did destroy a number of cities and villages in Galilee by the time they were able to capture and take control of Galilee. And so I'm not surprised that Sepphoris, a beautiful city, Greco-Roman style city on top of a hill with a breathtaking view, I'm not surprised that it became popular with Gentiles who moved into Galilee in the aftermath of that great war that went from 66 to 70, and the decline in Jewish influence and authority.
Talking a little bit more about Capernaum, are there any specific archaeological, I'm thinking here about artifacts or buildings or remains of buildings, that can be directly connected to gospel accounts involving Capernaum?
Yeah, I think we can. There is a synagogue which rests. Now, the synagogue itself that everybody sees at Capernaum, it's beautiful, it's limestone, and people see it and they think, oh, wow, this must be the synagogue Jesus was in. Well, no, it really wasn't. It dates to the 3rd or 4th century. But if you look carefully at the ground, you'll notice a black basalt foundation that's underneath the synagogue. And what you'll notice is it's out of square, and it slopes from left to right as you're staring as a tourist at the side of the synagogue. And you'll notice that the stonemasons, in making the third or fourth century synagogue out of limestone, they had to do a trick with the first tier of stone. They had to make the stones thicker and thicker as they went from left to right to make it level. Well, any modern builder would say, why in the world would you build on such a poor foundation? Unless, of course, the foundation was sacred. And that's the same idea you have in 1 Corinthians 3, where Paul talks about building on this foundation of Christ and the apostles. That's a Jewish thing. So I'm convinced that foundation made of the black volcanic basalt stone was the original synagogue, and that's why this beautiful synagogue of a later time was built on it. Even though it was such a poor foundation, it had settled, maybe an earthquake, who knows. It was out of square, no longer level. So do we have the original synagogue? Yeah, I think we do. We have the floor plan. Now, there's one other place at Capernaum, too, and it's called St. Peter's House, popularly. But you know what? I think it is, because archaeologists show that this was a private home in the first century, and before the first century was over, it was converted into a public meeting place. The stove was removed, the walls were plastered, extra oil lamps and lighting niches were put in. Why would you do that? That would increase the light, a plastered white interior wall with plenty of lights. It was so you could see better. It wasn't a private home anymore. It was a meeting place. And then you have all kinds of Christian graffiti, possibly even a couple of references to Peter himself. Well, I think for that to be converted into a Christian meeting place, and of course it evolved into an octagonal church later, there is only one explanation that makes sense, and that is people in the first century knew that was the house that belonged to Peter, and that was the very house in which Jesus taught when he was in Capernaum. So I think we do have a pretty fair chance of having both the synagogue and the house of Peter, where Jesus ministered during his time of residence at Capernaum long ago.
Returning to Nazareth, you mentioned before Jesus' kind of unfriendly welcome back to his hometown when he returns there after having spent some time in Capernaum. What does it tell you about the religious tenor, the religious atmosphere in the little town of Nazareth that Jesus is, he's received at the synagogue, but he's treated with considerable hostility by his hometown folks?
Well, that's a great question, Todd. I think what the answer is, it's a twofold answer. One of them, Jesus proclaims the good news. He focused on passages from Isaiah, and one of them was Isaiah 61, where the good news would be proclaimed to the poor. Well, the people of Nazareth very likely saw themselves as poor cousins compared to the people of Sepphoris or even the people of Capernaum, never mind down the coast a little further at Tiberias. And so here's Jesus, who's become well-known. He travels about. His ministry is financed. He himself doesn't actually have to work at carpentry or building or anything else. He is supported. He travels. And so he's celebrated. He's famous. He comes back to his hometown village, and they're expecting big things. You hear that in Luke chapter 4, where that version, the people at Nazareth say, "Do for us what you've done at Capernaum." They're expecting, I think, a privileged benefit from Jesus. I mean, Jesus is a local boy made good. You owe us. Instead, Jesus comes in and he talks about the good news being made available for everyone, including historic enemies of Israel. And he uses the examples of the ministries of Elijah and Elisha, famous prophets long ago, who did good things for Gentiles and not just for the Israelite people. And I think that really bothered everybody. So not only was Jesus not promising something doubly special for the Nazareth village, he was, even worse than that, he was suggesting that the good news applied to Gentiles also. And I think for the small-minded and very conservative folk that lived in Nazareth, that was just too broad-minded, too ecumenical. It was offensive. In fact, it might have even been viewed as borderline treason. So I'm not surprised that his reception was unwelcoming, or that even he was thrown out of the synagogue and thrust out of the village as somebody who wasn't honoring his elders and honoring his home roots the way they thought he should.
Dr. Evans, with only about 30 seconds here, tomorrow we're going to continue our series with you on biblical archaeology, talking about religious formation in the synagogue. What's on tap for tomorrow? About 30 seconds.
Well, tomorrow we're going to look at synagogues and a couple of things. One of them, of course, is what were synagogues? What happened in them? And were they important for Jesus? The other one is, were there really synagogues? There actually is a skeptical scholar out and about who says, you know what? They didn't exist in the time of Jesus, and therefore the Gospels are anachronistic. They're telling us things that didn't happen in the early first century but came about later. So I have a little bit of work to do tomorrow.
We'll pick it up tomorrow with Dr. Craig Evans. He is Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada, author of several books, including his latest called Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, look forward to tomorrow's conversation.
I do too. Thanks, Todd.
You know, it's remarkable that we have a Jesus Savior who comes, God in human flesh, into real history. Think about that. Being able to stand there on the ruins, albeit the ruins of a building where Jesus once stood. And when we're talking about Jesus standing there, we're talking about something more than just a famous historical figure occupying a place and a time in history. This is God entered into human history in the flesh to effect our salvation, to bring it about. But this is how God saves us. He doesn't save us from afar or long distance. He does not simply send a message from heaven. He sends His own Son. And those footprints wherein Jesus walked in Nazareth will eventually lead Him down to Jerusalem, where He will do what He has been sent to do. And in real history, in real time, a real man give his life on the cross for the salvation of the world. That's the kind of saving God that we have, one who sends His Son into our world, into our lives, into our history to save us, real sinners. And so this is why archaeology proves to be such a fast friend to Christianity. We're able to, through this science, through this art, locate this very real man, our God, Jesus Christ, where He did what He did for us. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Come on in and take your picture with my family in front of the White House. Check out the log cabin where I grew up. Let me know what you think of my campaign commercial. Look at Mary's fancy dress. She's mighty proud of it. Watch the Civil War like you've never seen it. Hunt for some of my treasures. And don't mind the ghosts. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois. A great place to hang your hat. Visit presidentlincoln.org. Illinois, mile after magnificent mile.